Succession number 9422, Reel 10.
Mr. Harold Haywood, Reel 10. You were telling me about your experiences as a runner, battalion runner, during the attack the 12th Gloucesters made on Inverness and Highwood area during the Battle of the Somme. Did you actually have to do any running missions, you know, during that attack?
Yes, I did. In fact, I was up, as it happened, with my company commander, Captain Beckett, when he had decided that he would have to withdraw his company because the battalion, the 1st East Surreys, on the flank, they hadn't got as far as his men had got, and they didn't get. So there they were exposed in a salient, and he had to make up his mind on his own quickly to withdraw them, otherwise the Germans would have come out and surrounded them and cut them right off. And of course he had to let the colonel know that, because the colonel thought that not only B Company but all the other companies in the line had gone forward. And so he wrote a message from his field pad, and to that effect, and gave it to me. He said, "Now take this back to the colonel," because I just happened to have gone up there. And when he'd made this decision about his own company, and I was to take it back to the colonel, you know, probably about something less than a quarter of a mile behind, I would think about 300 yards, and I set off with it on my own. I had been along that route fro and to and fro once or twice, so I knew which way to go, but there I was, you know, solo taking this thing. And
you'd have to go over the old no man's land, would you?
In fact, it was towards what the where our front line was, and where the German front line previously was behind it, parallel. And the Germans, of course, knew that to a nicety as regards range. And on the way back, the whole ground was blown right up, quite nothing even at all, you know, through HE, shelling our chaps before they went over. And on the way back from where they went over from, back to the colonel, where he was, which had been the German front line, you know, in the past couple of months, they knew all their artillery rangers, knew that to a nicety, and I think without making any boast of it, I think I had a battery to myself, because I was blown over twice from the force, but nothing happened to hit me. It was just the force of the explosion blew me down twice.
Were you under small arms fire as well, machine guns?
Oh no, because our own troops now were between me and the Germans. Not at all. No.
How did you go about getting across this 300 yards? Did you run at top speed?
How shall I do? This is obvious. Captain Beckett had told me what was in the message, and I knew the importance of it. And of course, if the colonel inquired me, the chap that I'd had with Beckett, I could have passed on by, you know, just conversation, apart from the official message that I took from a company commander to his battalion commander, announcing that he felt that on his own he had had to withdraw the troops which had obtained their objective because there was nobody on their flanks. And I got back, on the way back to the colonel, I was blown down twice. And
did you try and take shelter, or did you just
well,
run
there,
as fast?
There was no shelter there at all. But what I did think, I thought, well, now this is a valuable message, and I took it out from my pouch where I put it, and carried it tightly in my hand. But on the second occasion that I was blown down, I fell, and this went disappeared, and so I had no message, written message, from the company commander to the colonel. So I still pushed on and told the colonel what had happened. He wasn't at all pleased. So important a piece of information. He wanted to see at least the company commander's written statement to that effect. He just had to take my word. And I said, it hasn't been just, it hasn't been an easy walk down here because of the shelling between the company takeoff and the colonel's biddy, you know, dugout. And he had to accept that. I said, but if you like, I said to the colonel, I'll go back again and explain to Captain Beckett what has happened and get him to write another one. I mean, if you'd like to have confirmation just of private spoken word. And he felt pretty certain that what I had said was the facts.
So in this attack, Beckett had stayed in the British front line trench, and the troops had advanced to the German front line, and the message you carried back to wherever the colonel was in the support or reserve line had been that the British troops were going to fall back to the British front line. Is that correct?
Yes.
So that was the end of the attack on High Wood as far as your battalion was concerned?
Yes,
it?
As far as the brigade was concerned. I think it was a brigade affair, at least. That's all that I knew was what was happening in our company, the company I was in.
What was the condition of the company then when it came back from the attack on High Wood?
Well, I was, of course, at the colonel's headquarters then. I was then become his runner. And then the following morning, after the fellows had had a rest, they paraded as though they were on parade at Bristol in four companies, four platoons.
So you come back out of the line then?
We were then at least 4 miles away from the fighting, and it gave me such a shock to see the sparse number of people there. I really... because I was an onlooker, I hadn't been through it, and I felt probably a little bit sore to think that the battalion, you know, had done a good job and cost casualties, and I, as it happened, hadn't been one of them. I looked at it from the battalion headquarters to see these four companies set out in per company, per platoon, and instead of there being probably 30 to 40 men per platoon, in some cases there were just, say, six. In another case there might have been 15.
What about your own friends and your own platoon? Had there been a lot of...
Yes, I'd already been back to get in touch with them overnight to learn where so-and-so, you know, by name, because I knew all the fellows in the platoon, and I was asking about them. So, and they did say, well, two sections of the platoon are still up there. They didn't get the message to get back, and they said, well, they'll have been captured by the Germans. Well, as it happened, with them was a sergeant, not a Bristol's own. But he was a regular, and on the night when support had come up, he said, I'll go back, I'll fight, I'll get through to tell the colonel or the other regiment that has come up, here we are, but the 12th Gloucesters have gone back, they're occupying the line that we occupied. I'll go back and tell them that there's about 15 men up ahead, all by themselves, nearer to the Germans than to where they started off from. And he did get back to the headquarters, to the colonel, our own colonel, and this bunch of people waited till about midday the next day, and they troops were sent forward to them, and they came back to join the British Army, you might say, and of course through through the battalion, who then taken over back through them to where our own battalion had been withdrawn to, and the following morning, as I say, paraded as a battalion, and these fellows turned up and they said, where's so and so? They said, oh, well, he said that you were all cut off. He said, we weren't. He said he was going back to get somebody to take our place or give us instructions about retirement. And it was only when we did the following day, 12 hours later, that we did come back. We'd stuck out there. And they were going for him when he left, because he'd left them in the lurch. And they'd stayed there while he'd come back and made the colonel believe that he was the only one that had managed to cut his way back through.
And he got the MM for this supposed exploit.
Yeah. Because of his own story.
Did he stay with the battalion after that, or did he get a transfer?
No. They'd have killed him.
Do you mean that literally, or...?
I do indeed. I know Twofold and said, I'll get him.
How would they have done that?
Shot him. I don't know how. I wasn't with the platoon then, but I heard this chap say, if I see him, he said, I'll put him out.
So they felt that bad?
Wouldn't you?
I believe you met this this individual after the war.
Well, I didn't meet him, but it so happened I was working in the town of Gloucester, and I was walking down the Bristol Road when I saw a small party of council workmen go into the road and start to do some repair jobs. They didn't get on with it very well because one of them started talking on his own, and I had a look, and I a further look, and my eyes nearly jumped out of their head, because it was this sergeant telling them, no doubt, how he won the military cross, and that all the rest were leaning back on their picks almost with their mouths open, you know, at this story of heroism. So I couldn't stick this any longer. I stepped off the pavement and walked towards this man telling this story of his so-say heroism, and he looked up and saw me. Shut up. And the others looked at me and wondered who I was, you know, which would cause that. I hadn't spoken a word, but it had shut the mouth of the man they considered a hero. He'd got the military medal, but I've told you how he got it.
Had you actually lost any friends in the attack? Close friends?
No, my two friends who've been very close to me, they of course remained with their platoon. I was now attached to battalion headquarters.
What, do you remember the village you'd fallen back to?
I knew it for many years, but it's gone from me now.
What were you doing there? Was the battalion? Did you receive
reinforcements? What we call resting. This was a small alternative to what we had been told, or what we thought would happen. We were going to get Blighty leave. We didn't get Blighty leave. We were in fact sent back to this French village right behind the lines and behind the fighting. They'd never seen English troops before, and they were so pleased to see them that they let our fellows go and hunt in their wood, you know, foxes and things like that. We were quite heroes to them, because they knew we'd just come out of the line, and that we were there waiting for reinforcements to come up. And then I went round with Lieutenant Giddy to get particulars to be useful, you know, for whether their troops would be again billeted there, because there was a difference between how many men a village could sustain in billets in summertime rather than in wintertime. In wintertime, the barns are getting empty from what has been stored up in the harvest previously. More room for men. Then the corps want to know the depth of wells and everything which a battalion being in that village would be provided for on the spot.
And you say your reception was an enthusiastic one in this particular village.
Oh yes, because it so happened that the night before, quite by chance, their mayor, who had been a sous-officier in the French army, I think at Verdun, had been wounded, and he came back with his arm in a sling. It would have been something just for him to have returned, for him to come to their houses. In the normal way, the mayor doesn't go around to every small house, but of course he came with us because he knew of the people, and he knew what we, being a soldier, he knew what we were after, the purpose of it. And of course they trotted out everything the best they had, and they'd got some famous, I forget the name now, I've heard of it in the last 10 years, Normandy cider. It has its own name, and their cider isn't our cider. Their cider is our whiskey. That's to say, they take the liquid cider and distill it, because in those days anybody could distill if it was providing the apples or wheat was from your own ground, and of course they trotted that out. But they told Mr. Geddy, we'll have some of our cider, you know, a special thing, but for him and for the mayor. And of course he tossed it off the same as I had later on drank cider from the cider that was made at the Long Ashton research station, just an ordinary drink. And by the afternoon, of course, he didn't turn up in the afternoon. No wonder, he was drinking spirit by the half pint.
When you said that you were expecting Blighty leave, you didn't mean the whole battalion, did you? Could you explain what you meant?
Yes, it would mean to say that by arrangement, the colonel would, on the order room staff, make arrangement and perhaps say out of what would then be a matter of 150 out of, say, the 600 men who went into the line, the 150, perhaps 50 would be allowed to be away at one time, but they'd all get a week's blighty leave, but not all together. So the unit was in, was there. It was only just people from it back and return again.
You were there to get reinforcements as well. Did they arrive?
And to recover. Not me personally, except for the being blown down twice, I didn't go over the top.
What did the reinforcements arrive while you were in
Normandy? Yes, we got.
What? How did they fit into the battalion?
Well, of course, ours was a battalion quite different, except for about perhaps 10 or 12 similar battalions throughout the country. We knew each other before we enlisted.
A pals battalion.
The Pals Battalion, yes.
Were the reinforcements also from the Bristol
no,
area?
No, some of them were from the Gloucester Hussars. Obviously, by this time, the powers that be at the at command headquarters realized that the cavalry weren't going to have a ride through the gap made by the infantry. So and these were, some of them of course were pre-war cavalry, so old, you know, well trained soldiers, and others pass up in the cavalry perhaps from 1914, you see, till 1916, well trained men and good types, but some of them yeomanry, as I say, the Gloucester Hussars. We had a number of them come.
Did they fit in well? Were they assimilated?
Well, it's very difficult for me to say, because I'd been removed from the platoon back to battalion headquarters, and none of them went on that.
So you weren't really aware of what was happening in that?
Well, I think it went down all right. After all, they went off over at Guillemont together.
Now, you, I believe, were sent to Le Tréport for some local leave.
Not sent. I had the great opportunity of, because I happened to be at headquarters, of being one of those who was given 48 hours leave at the coast, and I chose Le Tréport to go down as a civilian, almost, except in military uniform. Had to pay everything, and but there I was, like I might be going now down to Brighton from here.
What did you do at Le Tréport?
Well, I tried to offered to teach a young lady to swim. She was in difficulties, and I was met with a very cold rebuke, no thank you. But she did, I'm sure, she was she probably had wished she hadn't been quite so standoffish, and I know that she was sort of looking round. I think probably she would like to have been taught, just to someone to hold, you know, her neck up and say, well, what a swimmer would tell anybody, his own sister, how to swim.
Did you stay at a local boarding house? Or
Yes, but I didn't stay long. It was only about 4 hours every night. After all, I had to pay for my fare down there. No, I forget. I didn't have to pay for my railway fare to the coast, but I had to pay for my board, putting up at the hotel.
What you mentioned earlier, the cavalry, that you know, some of them joined your battalion as reinforcements, the Gloucester Hussars. What did you think of the cavalry generally, and their usefulness or otherwise?
Well, we knew that there were cavalry somewhere back, well behind, possibly at the Commander-in-Chief's headquarters, and a lot of them which had never been in action, of them, of course, were not, no, they weren't just people who joined up like we had done at the beginning of the war, but they were whole regiments of cavalry who'd been pre-war soldiers, and we thought it a little bit odd that they hadn't been somewhere employed, but eventually they did come into the infantry, and we got some coming up with a draft, but additionally they formed the base of the machine gun corps, which was trained just to use machine guns. You know that they had a place somewhere in Lincolnshire, their headquarters, and they formed a big unit of their own, the same as it might be said the Navy or the artillery or anything like that.
I believe you once saw the Deccan Horse.
Yes, I did, in fact. It just came my way in carrying a message between Captain Beckett and the Colonel. I went down another, a different way from where I'd been before, and there I saw a horse, you know, dead, but all blown, you know, blown right out, which smelt badly, and I did go up to it to see who it was. I thought it would be one of our own, perhaps Scots Greys or Lancers or like that. But I saw on the horse's equipment, Deccan Horse. So I was able to tell people, well, I do know. I don't know in what degree, but I have seen the result of the cavalry having been in action. But there was only one or two horses with their equipment on, but no, but none of the troops. What casualties had been had either been buried or been taken back to hospital. They were the Indian troops.
What happened when you got back from Le Treport to the Normandy village? What happened
then? It was probably thought by the divisional general that the 95th Brigade had a good rest and it was time for them to go up into the line again.
Where in the line did you go?
Well, we went up into reserve and then we went up into support. And this was in the what was called Happy Valley, or some people called it Dead Man's Valley, and where I saw for the first time two of the woods. Each village seemed to have its own wood. One was on the way up we saw two of the woods, Trones Wood and Lurs Wood, which were just so many tree stumps. No tops to the trees at all, just these posts, as it were, standing up in the ground over a matter perhaps of half an acre.
Could you give me more an impression of the terrain generally at this time?
Yes, we did go up. We approached what had become the front line of the two opposing forces up a valley called Happy Valley or Dead Man's Valley. And it was whilst we were resting in this valley, I suppose then perhaps a mile from the actual fighting, that the Germans of course knew it because they'd occupied it, you know, within a month before, and we had to go without cooked food for one day because they dropped an HE shell on the cookhouse and took the sergeant cook's leg off. Naturally, we all would have thought, say in peacetime, that the cookhouse would be quite free from any likelihood of casualty, but it happened that way because there was an HE shell.
But the ground, what was the ground like?
Well, to my best of my recollection there, when I went up Happy Valley, it was grass covered. When we got farther up to the front, where the shelling had been, then it was nothing other than looking like a ploughed field in wintertime.
What about the villages? What were they like?
Well, we didn't go, as it happened, through any village, occupied or unoccupied. I didn't even see the village of Guillemot when we got there, because the at that time we want to. I think it was the thing to do. The Irish division were given the credit of actually capturing Guillemot, but of course you can't capture Guillemot. You can't capture a village if there are enemy troops on either side. They'll capture you, but it was given to the British troops to capture the ground which contained the village of Guillemot, but it was equally as difficult to capture the lines of trenches as it was the actual small village.